This week's news is exciting with some cool stuff to talk about and pretty bonkers because we narrowly avoided a security nightmare. A backdoor was discovered hidden in a common Linux utility, and it could have infected millions of devices. We'll break down how this almost happened and what it means for you. Then we'll switch gears and talk about some exciting upcoming features in Linux Mint 22. Fedora Linux might be getting a whole new look with a discussion about a proposal for switching the default desktop environment. And Flathub is making some changes to make it easier to identify whether or not a Flatpak is official. Plus, there is a new campaign for video game preservation that targets companies effectively breaking their games after an arbitrary amount of time. All of this and more on this episode, this jam-packed episode of This Week in Linux, your source for Linux. Good news. This episode of Twill is sponsored by Collide. More on them later. A backdoor was discovered hidden in a common Linux utility, and it could have infected millions of devices. So let's talk about that backdoor that was found in the XZ compression utility. Here's what we know about this backdoor that almost infected the world. That might seem like an exaggeration, but not really. XZutils is practically ubiquitous in Linux, and it provides lossless data compression. XZutils provides critical functions for compressing and decompressing data during all sorts of operations. XZ also supports the legacy .lzma format, making this component even more crucial. Andreas Fround, who is a developer and engineer working at Microsoft, was troubleshooting some performance problems in his Debian system, and he was experiencing some issues with SSH during some Postgres testing, or Postgres SQL, or PostgreSQL. Not sure, but I always say Postgres. Anyway, he noticed that the SSH logins were consuming too many CPU cycles and were generating errors with Valgrind, a utility for monitoring computer memory. Now, the backdoor used a sophisticated system of hiding this within a proverbial Russian doll of scripts and binaries. The backdoor manipulated SSHD, the executable file used to make remote SSH connections, and essentially made it possible for anyone in possession of a predetermined encryption key to put any code of their choice in an SSH login certificate. They could upload it and execute it on the backdoor device. And while no one actually has seen anything related for an upload, in theory, it could have allowed for just about anything. So, pretty big deal. Now, the attack appears to be the result of a meticulously planned social engineering campaign. The attacker, using the alias GIA T75, started this process in 2022 by posing as a concerned user and leveraging the support of other participants in the community. But those people also seem to be fairly new, and even some people referring to him as never seen before. So it was pretty sketchy on how they did it, because effectively they were bullying the dev that was involved with the actual maintaining of XZ, and they were claiming that they weren't doing a good job and even should be ashamed of themselves and stuff like that, which eventually led to effectively the attacker getting access to be a maintainer. And this is, some people were referring to this as because of developer burnout for the maintainer who originally had it. So this is a very, very unique and sophisticated attack in both the code system and also the fact that they use social engineering to do it. And there's a lot of stuff that we need to talk about. So with this access, GIA T75, which is now referring to themselves as GIA TAN, introduced the backdoor in XZ Utils version 5.6.0 and 5.6.1. The backdoor almost reached major Linux distributions like Debian and Red Hat. While it did reach some rolling release distros like Kali Linux and even Arch Linux and OpenSUSE Tumbleweed and stuff like that, some of these distributions weren't really that affected. So Arch Linux, for example, doesn't implement systemd in a way that would actually cause it to be affected, whereas OpenSUSE Tumbleweed and Kali do. So users who are affected would need to immediately address this, but for the most part, most users are not going to be affected, because if you're using a stable version of Debian, or you're using RHEL or CentOS or even Ubuntu, you're not really going to be affected by this situation because of the fact that all the people who would have been are using like the rolling release, the unstable versions and that sort of stuff. So if you're on the stable releases, then you're not going to be affected by this. But you almost were. And really what happened is crazy because it was basically luck that we were able to find this and address it and that sort of stuff. Andreas was not looking for security issues. He just accidentally stumbled upon this during his testing for Postgres, which is super interesting because the process of which required him to go through and find this problem was effectively some like security cryptographic stuff that he says he wasn't trying to do, but then ultimately did do. So by the way, Andreas, thank you very much for doing this because this was a huge find and this could have been a very big problem. And thank you again for doing this work because it was very critical. Now, researchers are still piecing together the details of this attempted attack, and we'll provide links to the full details for how it works if you're interested to learn about that. But effectively, what they did was they had the binary that was basically pretending to be a test suite, and the source code that created this was not actually visible in the Git source, which was really interesting because that's how they were able to hide it. And then it pulled in these testing suite stuff. And then from that, effectively, the binary was extracted into some scripts, which were then calling other scripts, and eventually bringing in this attack for this backdoor. So it's a very sophisticated attack in the fact that they, first of all, it's a very complicated structure of the Russian doll sort of thing like I mentioned, but also they spent years trying to get this to happen. And they were doing so in the beginning, seemingly being good stewards of the community, and then revealing themselves. Well, actually, they didn't reveal themselves at all. They were caught, but eventually they decided to implement this attack. So this was likely a meticulously planned out effort, and it could have been by one person. It could be by a bunch of people, but I mean, maybe we'll find out someday, but who knows? But ultimately, it falls down to the fact that this whole thing was created because this particular project was being maintained by an individual developer who had been doing it for a very long time, was not seemingly being paid by anyone, and the project itself was not getting funding. Yet, this particular project is a very crucial, crucial form of compression because it's used everywhere. Not everywhere, but basically it's ubiquitous at this point. It's used in so many things, to the point where it should have been like funded somehow, but it wasn't. So this effectively caused the developer to burn out, and having the bullying aspects of it happen and all this other stuff happening, well, I mean, it's not surprising that this happened in terms of that, because I mean, if you're one person running this massively important project, and it doesn't seem like anybody really appreciates that, I can see why burnout would be a thing. Absolutely. So one of the things we need to figure out is how to fund these kinds of projects, because it's not acceptable for these kinds of things to be maintained by one person in their spare time, volunteer base, and all these massive companies who are making billions of dollars depending on this particular thing and not helping out in any way. It's very weird, and hopefully this can be addressed in that case. There's also the case of like, how do you affect the social engineering aspect of it? And that's more of a societal approach of how do we, inside the community, make sure that these people are appreciated, and also make sure people are aware and informed about these kinds of attacks. And there's a lot of things to do here. And I'm not the person to answer these questions. I'm here to just give you the news. So now you know it, and luckily we found it. And also luckily Red Hat made a CVE based on this because it was important. And because of this news, I found out that the CVE system does not actually give numbers and associations to malware. They only do it for vulnerabilities. So this was not supposed to get a CVE number when it absolutely deserved it. So that's a very weird system that I did not know was as problematic as it was. So good on Red Hat for doing that. and letting everyone know. And also, again, good on Andreas. Thank you very much for putting in the effort to find this. I know it was accidental, but it's still, once you found the potential issue, you started digging. So that part, not that accidental. So thank you very much for finding it. And if you'd like to learn more about this, we covered it in much more depth on the next episode of Destination Linux. So check that out. I'll have it linked in the show notes, as well as links to articles related to this topic. Are you using FlatHub to install Flatpaks on your Linux system? Well, if you're not, you should, because Flatpaks are awesome. The FlatHub is really nice. It offers a wide variety of software. But if you are, you may have noticed some badges that are appearing on the website. And some of these badges that you've been there for a while, such as the verification badge, but now there's a new badge that is basically an unverified badge. So while you browse on FlatHub, you might see the blue verified badge next to some apps. And this means the developer has proven that they own the app in terms of maintenance, like showing a matching website or code repository. Not necessarily that they own the app, but more like they are the ones who are maintaining the Flatpak in the FlatHub. Now, this verification system helps build trust with users, especially with FlatHub offering like 1,000 verified apps and counting. So it's very cool that this exists. But there was always a problem with this, because if it wasn't verified, it just didn't say anything at all. Now it's very confusing, because if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't know that that meant that it was third-party maintained. But what about apps that are third-party? Now there is a new unverified badge. So that is really good. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the app is not something you should use. It just means that the original developer is not maintaining it in the FlatHub, but rather it's maintained by the community, which you could also apply that to the packages that are maintained inside of a distro, because while those distro pack maintainers are typically vetted to be the maintainers in the distro, they're not, they are officially third-party people compared to the actual source of the application. So here's the takeaway. Both verified and unverified apps go through a human review process by the FlatHub team before they are even available on the FlatHub. So you can rest assured that someone is looking out for your security. Now, this new system is all about transparency. By clearly showing the source of each app, users can now make informed decisions about the Flatpaks in the FlatHub. So FlatHub still encourages developers to get verified, but it's not required, and this is more helpful to that, so that people who are using the Flatpaks know this. Now, some of you might be wondering if there's a way to see this verification status outside of the website for FlatHub, and there is some work and discussion about making it possible in the command line, but that's not there yet. So the next time you browse FlatHub, keep an eye out on those badges and see whether or not they are official. And there is one thing I do want to say. This unverified badge thing is kind of weird. Also, the verified badge thing, it makes sense, but it also kind of makes me associate it to Twitter and how verified on Twitter now just means paying for it. So some people might even think that being verified on FlatHub means paying for it, but that's not what it means. It means that they are an officially maintained application in the FlatHub. But the unverified part seems more confusing. As in, unverified in what way? Not verified to be usable, not verified to be safe. Like, that's not the greatest way to describe it. I would say the better way is using a term like unofficial or third party maintained. Like, just be direct about it. Because unverified doesn't really convey clearly what it's supposed to be. At least, and not in my opinion. So it's good that they're trying to be more transparent with this, because this has been a problem for a long time. So I'm glad that they are making it clear that there is a difference. But I think they need to make the difference more of like, if you want to do verified, that's fine. That's cool. But also the unverified thing just kind of feels a little sketchy in terms of what it means. So people will still have a confusion related to it. I think like unofficial or third-party maintained or something like that. Community maintained, whatever. Something that is more clear would be better. So that's just my two cents. Let me know in the comments what you think about this news. And let me know what you think is the best way to describe it if you have other ideas. Let's talk about endpoint security. When you go through the airport, for example, there's a security line to check your ID and then another line to scan your bags. And the same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. And these days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of that equation, where they check the user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all in some cases. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has a firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months. Or worse, that laptop could belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide solves this problem, this device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on your devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD or bring your own device phone and laptop in your company. So visit thisweekinlinux.com/collide to watch a demo and see how it works. That's thisweekinlinux.com/KOLIDE. Have you ever bought a video game only to have it become unplayable later down the line? Well, you're not alone. This is a growing problem, but there is a new campaign that's trying to stop it, which is awesome, by the way. Traditionally, video games were sold as physical products, like a book or a movie. You bought the game and it was yours to play forever. But increasingly, well, I guess not forever. It depends on how long the console lasted and that sort of thing. But effectively, you didn't have any worry about it just being ripped away from you. But these days, games require an internet connection to function, even for single player modes. Like, you don't need internet connection, but they're forcing it upon us. Now, this not necessarily a bad thing, but it easily can be, because that means the publisher, not the player, has control over whether or not the game is playable. Now, I say it's not necessarily a bad thing to require internet connection because you can get updates and that sort of stuff. But in terms of, like, you need to have an internet connection just to play a single player local game, that is ridiculous. And that's not related to what this particular thing is, but that's another thing that's annoying about the video game industry. Moving on, recently, Ubisoft shut down the servers for a game called The Crew. So even if you bought the game, you can't play it anymore. The Crew had millions of players, and it wasn't that old of a game. Sadly, this isn't the first time this has happened, and it likely won't be the last, because this has become a growing trend, especially among AAA titles. So what's being done about this? Well, Ross Scott from the Accursed Farms YouTube channel, I think I said that right, is launching a new campaign called StopKillingGames.com. This is awesome. This is a push for governments to take action against this basically, it's anti-consumerism. This campaign argues that shutting down games like The Crew is unfair to consumers and hurts the preservation of video games as a whole. They're launching petitions in the UK, Canada, and Australia, with plans for more to come. And the biggest effort is in France, though, because France is the home country of Ubisoft, and that's kind of nice because for us gamers, since France is a country with one of the most robust laws for consumer protection. So thanks Ubisoft, I guess, for providing such a great basis for fighting this awful practice and also being in a country that makes it possible. So anyway, this is a complex issue. Publishers argue that maintaining servers for old games is expensive, but gamers point out that many of these games could still function offline. And even if they did need servers, they could at least set it up where we as gamers could spin up our own servers to play with our friends and that sort of stuff. And some people are saying that shutting them down is a way to force players to buy new titles. Now, I think it isn't fair to force a company to support a game perpetually, like in perpetuity, because nothing can really have a lifespan of forever. But at the very least, the gamers should be able to play the games they bought, even if it requires local only or setting up their own server. That's just my opinion. So I'm really happy about this campaign. The practice of removing the ability to play a game that someone paid for is not only unethical, it's basically lying, because that's not purchasing. That's called renting. In fact, some people might even call it theft, because they say that companies are taking people's money under false pretenses. And I fully support this campaign at StopKillingGames.com, but unfortunately, I am based in the United States, and I did not purchase the Crew game, so As explained by Ross in the video, which I will link in the show notes, I won't be able to do much more than spread the word about this campaign. So that's what I'm doing, as much as I can. And hopefully, people who are in the audience may be able to do something about it, because if you purchase the game, The Crew, then you could help with this campaign. And in some countries, you can help even if you didn't purchase it, just not here in the USA, like myself. So, anyway, good luck, Ross, and mad respect for the massive amount of effort this has already taken and will continue to take. So much appreciated, sir. The next version of Linux Mint, Linux Mint 22, is codenamed Wilma and is set to launch sometime later this year, probably around June/July. And it's packed with improvements, a lot of improvements, and the Linux Mint team have provided some info about what to expect. So let's dive in. First up, say hello to Pipewire, because the new default sound server is going to be Pipewire, which promises smoother audio processing, better resource management, and seamless integration with your favorite applications. It's basically a drop-in replacement. So there's no more struggling with compatibility and that sort of stuff, because Pipewire handles everything. And I'm really happy to see this, because every distribution at this point should be using Pipewire by default, because it offers so much awesome features. And of course, thanks to Ubuntu implementing it by default, now Linux Mint can do that as well. So fantastic. Another big shift is how Linux Mint handles kernel updates. Currently, users stick with the initial kernel, which was included in the release, which is 15.5, I think, for the Linux Mint 21 series. But with Mint 22, you'll get access to the latest Ubuntu hardware enablement kernels automatically. This means your system will stay compatible with newer hardware and benefit from the latest performance tweaks and security fixes. Now, this is not as in like it's going to get it as fast as the kernel comes out. It's going to get it when the Ubuntu kernels are updating. Now, of course, if you prefer stability over updating support because of reasons, and you want to stick with the original kernel, that is going to be an option as well. But I think it's really cool that Linux Mint is implementing this, because Ubuntu has it automatically giving you updated kernels. And now with this new change for Mint 22, Linux Mint users are going to get the same benefits. Here are some other cool things to look forward to in Mint 22. The ability to work with JXL images, a new high-efficiency image format, which is available directly in the Pix Photo app. There's going to be distro-agnostic front-ends for GNOME online accounts, because there's some changes here and there depending on the support for GTK3 and GTK4 with the GOA, the GNOME online accounts. This is good because it ensures smooth integration across your applications, and it's also going to be possible to use these things, these front-ends, regardless of what Linux distribution you have, so that's very cool. And also, finally, Linux Mint is taking the lead in packaging Thunderbird as a native dev package for those who prefer that format over the Snap package, which will be offered in Ubuntu 24.04. And on top of these features, we already know that Mint 22 will include a new tool for organizing Nemo actions and a chat room app called Jargonaut. So there's a lot of cool stuff, and with all these exciting changes, Linux Mint 22 is shaping up to be a really cool release, minty fresh even. And it's due later this year. So be sure to stay tuned for updates. And if you haven't subscribed to the show, you should do that right now. Are you a Fedora Linux user? You might be in for a bit of a surprise in the next year with the Fedora 42 release, because a proposal has been submitted to shake things up quite a bit in the world of Fedora and the desktop spins. For those who aren't familiar, Fedora Workstation traditionally uses GNOME as its default desktop environment, and has done so for a very, very long time, I think always. But this proposal suggests a switch to KDE Plasma instead. Now, KDE Plasma is another popular desktop environment known for its customization options and powerful features, and is also my personal daily driver, but that's not really related to why they did it. It's just a quick side note that I wanted to share. So why did they do it? Why the potential switch? Well, the proposal argues that KDE Plasma 6 offers a great user experience, strong industry support, lots of customizations and control, and powerful features, and solid Wayland compatibility. And for those who are not familiar with Wayland, that's a new display server tech replacing X11 at some point. We don't know when, but it's definitely going to happen eventually. Now, this is just a proposal, and there's a long way to go before anything is set in stone. So will KDE Plasma become the new king of Fedora desktops? Well, Fedora has a long history of GNOME, so probably not, but only time will tell. And I think it would be very interesting if it did happen because, well, I'd love to see a big player in the Linux distro space use KDE Plasma as the default because it's one of the best desktop environments available and it deserves the spotlight and it isn't really getting that spotlight. So I would love to see that happen. And we'll keep you posted on how this story unfolds. But in the meantime, if you're curious about the new version of KDE Plasma with KDE Plasma 6, you could try it out on the upcoming Fedora 40 release. And if you don't want to wait for the new release, which is expected sometime later this month, you can check out the beta release that is available right now. Are you ready for this? Redis, a popular in-memory database used for caching, has made some licensing changes that are causing a stir. Previously, Redis offered a permissive license that allowed anyone to use and modify the code freely under the BSD 3 license. But now, they've switched to a dual license model with much stricter terms. This change didn't sit well with many developers, including some who were core contributors to the project, and in response, some forks have been made by different groups with different goals. SourceHut, for example, has started a fork called Redict or Redict, not sure, and a group led by the Linux Foundation has created a fork called Valky. Both Redict and Valky are based on the latest fully open source version of Redis, which is 7.2.4, and aims to continue development under a more developer-friendly license. Several major tech companies are also backing the Valky branch or the Valky fork, including AWS, Google, and Oracle. So what does this mean for you? Well, if you're a casual Redis user, you might not need to worry too much in the short term, because you can likely keep using the existing open source version for a while. However, if you're a developer who relies heavily on Redis, you'll want to keep an eye on this situation. Redict is focusing on stability and maintenance, while Valky seems more ambitious for long-term evolution of the project. But both could be viable alternatives in the long run. You may be wondering, what is the difference between those two, Redict and Valky? Well, Drew Default of Redict has said that in technical terms, by the way, this is a quote from Drew, in technical terms, we are focusing on stability and long-term maintenance and on achieving excellence within our current scope. We believe that Redict is near feature complete and that it is more valuable to our users if we take a conservative stance to innovation and focus on long-term reliability instead. This is in part a choice we've made to distinguish ourselves from Valky, whose commercial interests are able to invest more resources into developing more radical innovations, but also an acknowledgement of a cultural difference between our projects, in that the folks behind Redict place greater emphasis on software with a finite scope and ambitions towards long-term stability, rather than focusing on long-term growth and scope and complexity. So that's the difference between Valky and Redict from the person who started Redict. Now, Microsoft has taken a different approach to this. Instead of forking the code, they've created their own Redis-compatible caching solution called Garnet. So the world of in-memory databases is getting pretty interesting. We have Redis with its new licensing, the new forks, Redict and Valky, and Garnet, the alternative from Microsoft. Ultimately, the choice of which solution to use will depend on your specific needs and preferences. And while no one can say what the outcome of this will be, I don't think any of us were ready for this. It looks like Serpent OS might be slithering onto your systems very soon. Well, soonish. We first talked about Serpent OS back on the episode Twill 202 on June 18th, 2022, so it's exciting to see that we're going to be getting a chance to play with it soon. Well, in a pre-alpha stage, but still, I'm excited. Serpent OS, led by Ikey Doherty, the founder of Solus Linux, is nearing a pre-alpha release in just a few weeks. What is Serpent OS, I hear you asking? Well, Serpent OS is an independent Linux-based operating system built upon a variety of open-source technologies. Most importantly, it is an attempt to provide an installation, as they say, a sane installation that cannot be broken by updates. It does this through a variety of recovery mechanisms, including on-disk offline rollbacks and system deduplication. Now, this is really interesting also because they have been paying attention to the development of Cosmic, the innovative Rust-written desktop environment from System76. So there is potential for them to offer Cosmic as an option within Serpent OS, which would be very, very, very interesting to see. Now, some other things about Serpent OS is that they have their own package management system called MOS, and they say it is blazing fast. And based on Solus, blazing fast is probably true because that thing is very fast. Also, atomic transactions are going to be included. Every package management operation creates an entirely self-contained transaction, offering rollbacks to earlier points in time, as well as ensuring updates are safe to apply. Now, some A to B transaction systems don't have that kind of guarantee. So that's interesting that Moss is making that guarantee, even saying that Moss can make the new system root available immediately. So very cool. Very cool. Also, the core tooling is written in Rust with support tooling in the process of being ported, memory safe, and they even say it's extremely fast in execution. Now, the wait is almost over. SerpentOS developers are aiming to release pre-alpha ISOs in the coming weeks, with more news expected by the end of April. And if you're curious about the new Linux experience, SerpentOS might be something to sink your fangs into. Get it? Serpent, snakes, fangs. Links in the show notes. A new release of the open source video editor Flowblade has just landed, packed with new features to enhance your editing experience. This new version, Flowblade 2.14. By the way, Flowblade is a very cool name, and it looks cool as written, but it's also kind of hard to say. Flowblade. Flowblade. Okay, I might get used to it during this segment. Flowblade 2.14 brings exciting improvements such as adding support for USB jog shuttle devices. This means you can use dedicated controllers like Contour Shuttle Pro to scrub through footage with ease and making editing smoother and more intuitive and that sort of stuff. Those kinds of things are really cool. I don't have a Shuttle Pro, but I have used stuff like that in the past and they are very nice. But that's not all. Flowblade 2.14 also lets you add titles and edit them directly on the timeline. No more jumping back and forth between these tasks. You can fine-tune your titles right alongside your video clips. And also, speaking of clips, Flowblade 2.14 gives you even more flexibility. You can now paste clips directly at the playhead position, perfect for inserting quick edits on the fly. And for those artistic touches, graphics clips can now be stretched to any length that you want. And if you've ever wanted to create slow motion sequences, Flowblade 2.14 has you covered. This update lets you add slow motion effects to your videos. On top of these headline features, Flowblade 2.14 boasts a variety of filter updates, including new options for elastic distortion and audio compression. And there are also a bunch of bug fixes to keep your editing experience running smoothly. Why did I say smoothie? It's late in the show, I guess, people. Now you might be wondering about the future of Flowblade. The developers are hard at work on a major upgrade, porting the interface to the GTK4 toolkit. This will bring a more modern look and feel to Flowblade. While the GTK4 update is expected in 2025, the good news is that 2.4 is a very welcomed update and is available right now. So if you're looking for a free open source video editor with some great new features, be sure to check out Flowblade 2.14 and happy editing. Thanks for watching this episode of This Week in Linux. If you like what I do here on this show and want to be kept up to date with what's going on in the Linux and open source world, then be sure to subscribe. And of course, remember to like that smash button. And if you'd like to support the show and the Tux Digital Network, then consider becoming a patron by going to tuxdigital.com/membership, where you can get access to a bunch of cool perks like access to patron-only sections of our Discord server and much, much more. You can also support the show by ordering the Linux is Everywhere t-shirt or the This Week in Linux shirt at tuxdigital.com/store. Plus, while you're there, check out all the other cool stuff we have, like hats, mugs, hoodies, stickers, and so much more. tuxdigital.com/store. I'll see you next time for another episode of your source for Linux GNUs. Thanks again for watching. I'm Michael Tennell. I hope you're doing swell. Be sure to ring that notification bell. And until next time, I bid you farewell.